So I wanted to come back today, sort of finish off our kind of black hole week, by talking about thermodynamics of black holes. So we... I've only just started! Yes.
Could yeah. you go over the last bit of the last lecture, like the way this space-time got...
Oh yeah, no, that's actually, that's a good question, because it's something that sort of, it takes a bit of wrapping around. So at the end, so the question was to just, would I mind going over just the very last bit of yesterday's lecture where we talked about the overall space-time of the domain wall. So I'm very happy to do that. Do we have some other votes for talking about that? Yep, loads of hands, great. Okay, so what's interesting about it is that it's a process of compactification, which means that it's taking something that's infinite and making it genuinely finite. But in this case, it's a sort of physical object that's doing that. So that's why it's kind of interesting. The other thing that's interesting about it is that it's another illustration of how coordinates can sometimes fool us or sort of misdirect us. We have sets of coordinates, and somehow we start assigning meaning to them. So when the space-time of the wall, I'm going to write on the side for this, was first explored, they started off because, you know, as I sketched, we had our solution, which was like a Tansch function, and it looked like you had a planar wall. It looked like the coordinates on the wall were like x and y, so it was planar. And when the space-time of that solution was initially found, it looked like it was singular. And the reason it looked like it was singular was because, remember, we had this term, a sort of kappa over L squared, which I'd written it, you know, in this format, where the kappa would have been the curvature of this space. And so if you didn't put that there, your equations of motion were basically not going to solve, which means that if you tried to solve them with a sort of illegitimate initial state, you end up finding a singularity. So that was the first attempt. Then some relativists got into the action, and they said, well, hang on, we don't have to have this being planar. You know, let's actually make it sort of expand a bit in time. And so which effectively was adding a kappa. And then they found the solution that we found yesterday. And then they noticed that it was Riemann flat outside the wall and said, okay, so it should have a coordinate transformation, which was the one that I wrote down. However, to understand what the full structure of the space-time was, that was actually probably about 10 years later by Gary Gibbons, where he sort of said, okay, so if you do have this transformation, what that means is that you can take the space-time away from the wall, which is flat, and you can regard the wall, roughly speaking, as a boundary to the space-time. So when we had our coordinate transformation between the wall-based coordinates and the ones that were explicitly flat away from the wall, we saw that our wall, our z equals zero, was a hyperboloid. So we had that. So if this is our... We had rho squared minus tau squared equaled L squared for the center of the wall. So that was when we derived that, I'd said we were looking at z greater than zero. Now, the coordinate transformation I gave was strictly only valid outside the core of the wall. So we sort of expect that this is a little bit of fuzz here where there's a, you know, there should be some curvature, but this is a pretty good approximation for the big picture of what's going on. But we had this approximate metric that was valid away from the wall. So if I look at this function here, this was for z bigger than zero. If I wanted z less than zero, I had to add z. So what this function is something that's doing this. If I didn't take into account the energy density of the wall, it would have a very sharp jump. It would be going up and it would be going down. So the energy density of the wall just sort of smooths that off. But it's symmetric for z goes to minus z. So everything we did is, from a geometrical perspective, was symmetric by swapping z and minus z. So this picture that we derive for z bigger than zero has an exact same counterpart for z less than zero. So we're left with, well, this is z greater than zero and z less than zero. So what it's telling us, I know we're supposed to leave it there, but I keep banging into it, is that our full space time from the perspective of a natural observer not living on that wall is the interior of a hyperboloid, and we're either on the plus interior, the plus vacuum, phi is plus eta, or we're on the minus interior, phi is minus eta, the minus vacuum. So to get the full space time takes us continuously from if I'm sitting away from the wall and I send one of my graduate students off in a rocket send them through the wall, what's going to happen to them is they're going to hit the wall, and then they're going to carry on and go straight through it. So I think what's slightly difficult to visualize is because although it's flat away from the wall, it's quite, from a global perspective, this is distinctly a non-trivial manifold. And so when we're trying to draw things, it can be difficult to represent the curvature of the manifold. So here, if I ask what happens on a constant time slice, I've got something that is basically like the interior of a three-sphere that then curves. It doesn't help the fact that I'm so not artistic. That kind of curves round in a very narrow region, the width of the wall. So you could think of this as a tortilla. It's something that's essentially flat. And if you thought of the surface of the tortilla, that's, if you know, going one dimension down, that's an S2. But it doesn't look like an S2 because you've squashed it right down so that on each side, your local space is flat. But as you go from the top to the bottom, you're passing through a region of very strong curvature. And that region of very strong curvature is the core of the wall. So that's kind of what's happening. So it always, when you're thinking of manifolds, what I've done there with drawing the two hyperboloids is I've taken a coordinate chart, a chart that is on the plus side of the wall, and I've mapped that into a different chart, which is the interior of the hyperboloid. I take the space away from the wall on the minus side and map that into the interior of the hyperboloid again. And then the wall itself, which is where all of the space-time curvature is happening, we use our actual wall-based coordinate. So if you like, I've split my space into three patches, three open sets. I've got an open set around the wall that I have t, z, and theta and phi. And that's where all the curvature happens. Remember, I wrote down my A of Z hat was something like, I don't know the, because I haven't got it with me, but something like a log cosh Z hat plus extra pieces, which interpolated between the 1 plus Z on L to 1 minus Z on L. I've then got another two open sets, the plus and the minus, which, again, I mean, we've got one coordinate patch, TZ, theta, phi, but this coordinate patch has a horizon at Z equals L or minus L. And so what all I'm doing is I'm taking this patch here, doing a coordinate transformation over to the interior of the hyperboloid there, this patch here, another coordinate transformation to the interior of a hyperboloid, which I can then explicitly, these tau and rho coordinates take me beyond Z equals L. And so to get the full space-time, I'm simply taking the plus side and gluing it to the minus side. So it's, you know, it's definitely not a trivial thing, but it's using this idea of coordinate patches, the fact that your manifold is only ever locally looking like R to the N, and this one does a great job of looking locally like R to the N because it is locally R to the N away from the wall. And you're always sort of gluing together these different coordinate patches. So we started with one, which had limits, two horizons at Z equal plus or minus L. And then we did coordinate transformation so that this patch over here, we map literally into R4, which was the interior of the hyperboloid. And on this side, we can do the same thing. And so our full space-time is just the sort of gluing together of these different patches, just like our atlas of the world. Our Earth is represented by the sheet atlas. Yes?
Can you explain this when you draw somebody on the hyperboloid? I don't understand the arrow if they are inside or
outside. Oh, so here, this is just a world line or, you know.
But is it inside, outside, or on the face?
So this one, right. So, yeah, it's inside. So here's my hyperboloid around me. And so the idea is someone is coming. I'm sitting at the center, right in the middle of this, and I send somebody out. So that's their world line. As they go out, eventually they hit this. Actually, they don't. I'm sitting back here. So eventually they hit this hyperboloid, but this coordinate patch that I am in is only valid up to the hyperboloid. So when I get around the hyperboloid, I have to change to the other. You know, so it's like turning the page over and the map.
So you are inside another hyperboloid.
Yeah, so they then go inside another hyperboloid.
And, the walls of the hyperboloid is the wall?
Yeah, so the wall, exactly, it is the wall. So when you're following a geodesic, you know, if you have more than one coordinate patch, you have to sort of translate through from one to the next. Mm-hmm. So it's as if you have a world line here and you have one coordinate patch I don't know if this is going to... You know, your coordinates have a limit to their regime of validity. So then you have to. So this is like turning the page on the roadmap. You start off here. You turn the page. You go. You carry on. You realize you're coming to the edge of the page of your roadmap, and you turn the page again. And you have to just sort of, you know, sometimes you have to just make sure you've gone. Okay, I'm in here. You know, so that's exactly that process. So here. So technically, we'd start off in this patch, we'd get near the core of the wall, which is very thin, but nonetheless not zero thickness. We'd pop over to this one, so we'd come in somewhere like this, we'd follow our geodesic through the core of the wall. Once we're on the other side, we pop now to the next sheet of the map, and the interior of this hyperboloid. Yep.
I don't understand the statement that the wall is now compact.
The wall, so because once you've got this hyperboloid here, it's spatially compact. So if I cut across the hyperboloid on a space-like surface, it's finite. The space-like volume of my manifold is finite. So that's what I meant by compact.
But it wasn't it before as well?
When we started off, we made no assumptions. So what we wrote down, our original metric was, have this as just some general function, a squared of z. Formally, before we started, in fact, our background solution, which is flat space, was a zero of z equals, actually, no, it isn't, not with that there. So when I wrote down my metric initially, I hadn't actually written this down. I'd written down, we started off with dt squared minus dx squared minus dy squared minus dz squared. So that was how we started. That was our background solution, which was the tanh of z solution. So initially, our space was infinite. Our flat space background was infinite. We then did a correction. We sort of identified an expansion parameter epsilon, which represented the gravitational strength of the wall. Essentially, how energetic is the wall relative to the Planck scale? As long as it's small, we can do this step-by-step process. So our original space was non-compact. But then when we calculated the gravitational back reaction, we found that actually, we'd been fooled, if you like, that the wall was really very gently curved, curved at a scale L, given by the scale, the relative sort of energy scale of our field to the Planck scale. And what that meant is our space-time now closes off. So it's not that flat space was the wrong thing to do, because space is still flat off the wall. It's just that the fact that we had infinite flat space was the wrong thing to do. But it's not even the wrong thing to do. It's just a starting point. We write down coordinates, and we accept that they may not be universally valid. Our coordinates may have a coordinate singularity somewhere, just like the Schwarzschild solution. We can get the Schwarzschild solution as a linearized solution to gravity. We find there's an event horizon, and so we see that there's a strong effect somewhere, and then we step back and we decide, is that a trick? Is it a sign that we, you know, is it an aspect of linearizing gravity, or is it something that's really there? In the case of the Schwarzschild solution, the event horizon is really there. And in this case, it's the same thing.
The thing is that from one step, the initial guess to the next step, what you did was to introduce a matter distribution and then solve the isentropy.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you're saying that a matter distribution can change global topological properties on space time.
In this case, yes. And it also does for codimension two.
And I'm kind of confused because a few lectures ago I asked about the variational problem,
mm-hmm.
and I asked if the manifold was given. And that was true, as you said. So I thought that it was kind of like we determine before solving Einstein equations the global topological properties and the Einstein equations.
So I guess in this case, I would say, well, actually, so you know, the space-time of the wall sort of is, you know, it is what it is. When we have been trying to find it, we start off via an imperfect first approximation to it. So our space-time is, you know, locally approximately flat. The question is, how far does that description extend? So from our perspective, if we're sitting inside the wall, the curvature is kind of, you know, gradually sort of taking us from, you know, a prime disorder is minus epsilon to a sort of plus epsilon. So locally, it's not like anything dramatic is happening locally, but when we step back and draw the hyperboloid, it's like we've taken now a step back. We're looking at the whole space-time, so our perspective has changed of length. And so suddenly it looks like this, you know, we see an exactly flat space-time that's strongly curved around the edges. So it's a question of perspective in this case, of not doing anything wrong by writing down this flat space. It's just giving us a starting point to find the solutions. So,
it's just, it's not quite clear to me if I can just like create a big machine that throw a bunch of matter in some distribution that I choose in space-time, yeah, and in that way I can make a hole in the manifold so that it's not simply connected anymore. So like, can I do these kind of things in GR or no?
I guess, yes, you can. In the sense that, you know, we have all sorts of different exact solutions corresponding to different sorts of sources which have different topologies. You know, we always, when we're actually calculating something, we always have to write down an explicit metric. So we always have to sort of pick a coordinate system to get started. And once we've picked a coordinate system, we have to acknowledge that that will only be valid within some range, which is our open set U from the definition of the manifold. So there's, if you like, there's the reality of finding an exact solution where we have to write down coordinates, make assumptions about symmetries, and make decisions about how to proceed. And then there's the God's picture, if you like, you know, stepping back and looking at the manifold as a whole, which is, you know, exists from t equals minus infinity to plus infinity. So there's the sort of these two different pictures, if you like, that go hand in hand. And in, you know, the manifold, the solution is the full thing itself, but when we are working to find the solution, we're always looking, we're always sort of compromising, we're always writing down a coordinate system locally. And then added on top of that, here I'm actually giving you a precise solution. On top of that, in real situations such as cosmology, we have this perspective where we want to, we are creatures that live in time, and we want to be able to describe an evolution of a system. So that even departs even further from our perspective of space-time as the full manifold. So I think I've probably got to stop now and move on with the topic. But I think it's what the sort of questions that you are asking are more to do with perspectives of what we're doing when we're doing sort of different aspects of thinking about gravity. So let's see how much we get done now. So I guess the main message that I do want to cover today is just to talk about finding the Euclidean action of Schwarzschild so that I can sort of give you an argument of how you find thermodynamic quantities via a sort of, you know, pseudo-Euclidean quantum gravity approach. So remember that we had looked at Euclidean Schwarzschild. Thank you. And we discovered that the Euclidean time was periodic if we wanted to have a non-singular manifold. So we have a sort of picture, sometimes called a black hole cigar. So this is what our T or tau R plane looks like. It's completely non-singular. If we have a very specific periodicity of time, so delta tau should be 8 pi gm. So that's what our space-time looks like, or it's one, you know, I mean, we could, pictures that we draw are only ever approximations or certain points of view. So this is just looking at RT. And we, if we want to calculate the action, R is zero. But we don't necessarily have a zero boundary term. So if I think of this literally, I want to truncate my space at finite r, do calculate my action, and then send r to infinity. Yeah, so that's Ricci. I realize I've got more than one r here. That's going to be our strategy for calculating this action. So if I have a surface at finite r, then the normal to my surface is going to be proportional to the radial direction. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what was big R?
Big R is the truncation. I'm truncating at a large value of R. So I'm truncating my space at large radius. So now I've got, so I'm thinking of it as just being at some large R. I've cut off my space-time. That gives me a boundary, an explicit boundary, that I want to let go to infinity because my real black hole space-time goes off to R equals infinity. So I'm going to stop at finite r, where I've got sort of, you know, finite terms in my k, and then I'm going to see what I get. So to calculate k, I need the normal, and my normal is this in this direction, the radial direction. So my k is proportional to d by dr. Sorry, my normal is proportional to d by dr. So n, my normal, so I'm defining, I'm just sort of writing, if remember when we did found our metric, we called it a squared, 1 minus 2 gm on r. So that's the normal to my surface, and then the extrinsic curvature . So k is the divergence of the normal. Which we have quite a nice compact way of calculating just from partial derivatives by an expression with root g. So root g for this metric is r squared sine theta, and I've only got one component of my normal, which is the radial component. So all I pick up is d by dr of this function here. So this is what my extrinsic curvature is, and I have to evaluate that at this large radius, capital R. So that's how I find my extrinsic curvature. I've got to take the divergence of the normal of surfaces at constant R and evaluate it at capital R. So here, this is 2 square root of 1 minus 2 gm on R divided by capital R plus gm on R squared, square root of 1 minus 2 gm on R. That's my K. So what my boundary integral is here is the integral d3x on the boundary, root h times k, that's what it is. So let me look at these different terms. So d3x, the boundary is parameterized by the tau angle, and I've got the two sphere coordinates, theta and phi. So here I've got the integral d tau, d theta, d phi. The metric on the boundary is given just by taking the tau, theta, phi pieces. So that is the square root of that metric is r squared sine theta times a at r. And then I've just calculated this value here. So I've got k my extrinsic curvature. So nothing in the integral, other than the sine theta, depends on tau, theta, or phi. So I simply get 4 pi from my sphere integral, beta from the tau integral. And then if I look at what this gives, I've got r squared. Then I've got 2 a squared of r divided by r plus gm over r squared. So remember, a squared is 1 minus 2 gm on r. So I get 2r minus 3 gm. So this was the reason that I truncated my space-time at finite r, because I have a term that is not finite, or will not be finite, when I let my boundary become infinitely large. So this, we've gone from having a zero action, which was no good, to now having an infinite action, which isn't very good either. So let's sort of stop again and just think about what's going on. Why is this blowing up? Well, first of all, notice that there's no mass, explicitly at least, in that term. So if I were looking at flat space, if I set gm to zero, but I still have a periodic Euclidean time, I would still have a divergent action. So given that flat space or empty space, Minkowski space-time is the sort of absolute vacuum of gravity, we would sort of expect that to have zero action. So this is, if you like, a spurious infinity. This is like an infinite vacuum energy. And so what we can do is the sort of standard procedure of renormalization, which is to subtract off the energy of empty space. So that's the process I'm going to do here. I think David's got quite a nice tutorial about boundary terms. Are you going to do that one with ABS? Yeah. So what we're going to do, but we'll not, he's got a sort of nice alternative method, but we'll do the simple one here. So we're going to take our bare action, which we just calculated, which is infinite, and we're going to subtract off the action of empty space. And we're going to say that our real action of the black hole is the difference between these. So geometrically, if you like, what I'm doing is I'm going to take my black hole cigar, my cut off at R, and then I'm going to take a flat cylinder, that's my empty space with the same periodicity, and I'm going to just subtract these two, one from the other. So, in flat space, my flat background, what I have to do is I have to match my manifolds at the boundary. These two background, these two geometries have to have the same boundary, which means I have to put in this factor here. So I just put a constant. I want it, my tau coordinate is now the same, but I give it just this constant prefactor so that the two manifolds match up on the boundary. They have the same angular time coordinate, the same periodicity, and they're the same volume form, they're same geometrically. So the only difference between the extrinsic curvature of the black hole and the extrinsic curvature of the flat background is that M equals zero. So that's just 2/R. And then to find the actual contribution of the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, I now have to take integral d3x of root h, which is r squared sine theta, root 1 minus 2gm over r, times k, which is 2/R. So I think the only thing that's slightly unexpected, or that, you know, until you sort of think about what you're doing, is the presence of this term in this integral. You would think, oh, I just take the completely fat integral, which is just, you know, my volume element is just r squared sine theta, because I would just have, I would just d tau squared plus dr squared. But if you are doing a background subtraction, you must have your boundary manifolds agreeing. And although the periodicity of the tau angle in the black hole space is beta, the length of the tau circle is not quite beta. It's beta times the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r. That's why we have to put this piece in here. So we get a 4 pi beta from our integral with respect to theta phi and tau, and then we get 2r times the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r, which we then Taylor expand. To get this factor of GM. So my actual renormalized action is going to be minus 1 over 8 pi G. I have to take the calculation I got for the bear action for, I think I've forgotten 8 pi G somewhere, the bear action for the Schwarzschild solution, which is 4 pi beta into 2r minus 3 gm. And then I subtract off my background action, which is 4 pi beta into 2r minus 2 gm. Which is beta m on 2. Yeah. So I've now got a finite answer. That I guess what we're saying here is that because of the way we've chosen to coordinatize our space, and therefore the boundary that we've taken, this divergent part is an aspect of that choice. It's the way we've chosen the boundary and chosen coordinates. And so it's not really a true divergence. It's something that's a bit, it's fictitious. It's due to the way we have parameterized our space-time. And it would be there even if space-time was empty. And so the appropriate thing to do is to do this background subtraction. And what we find is that the action of our black hole is a simple product of its mass times the periodicity of Euclidean time. So we're going to kind of input that into our rather flaky expression, which was the trace of the for various states with the same charges, sort of fixed beta and any other charges that we have, of e to the minus Euclidean action. So we take our classical solution to be, there will be saddle points of that action. So that's kind of the idea. So our entropy is given by a derivative of this partition function with respect to temperature, or inverse temperature. So putting in our Schwarzschild action, log of Z is just the Euclidean action itself, which is beta m on 2. And so what I get is a half beta squared dm by d beta. Uh-oh. I don't know what I've done there. So the mass is simply linearly proportional to beta, and so my entropy S should be 1/2 beta squared times 1/8 pi g. But my beta is 8 pi g m, so that's 1/16 pi g times 4 pi squared times 2 g m squared. Yep.
Can you clarify again why you write a flat background that with that refactor in the Zell square?
So that is so that the boundaries are the same. We have to have identical boundaries to the manifold. So what that means is that we want to have our tau coordinate to have the same periodicity beta, but if I make my tau coordinate have periodicity beta, it will not match with this metric here. We don't worry about the dr. I mean, the boundary metrics won't match unless I've got this factor in here. So if you like, pictorially, the other side, pictorially, although it's very close, it's very nearly flat, it's not quite flat, it's got a 1/r piece. So this is my Schwarzschild solution. If I didn't shrink my cylinder, if I just had this would be the tau squared plus dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. If I didn't shrink in my cylinder, the two boundaries would be different, right? So I have to shrink it to make them fit.
One more question. When you're doing this weak rotation and studying the statistical system, what's the statistical system you are considering? It's like one fixed time
it's slightly dodgy doing this, right? Because normally if you're doing field space on flat, you know, field theory in flat space at finite temperature, and you Euclideanize your time, you would make a periodic, and that would represent a system in thermal equilibrium. So it's slightly illegal because the black hole isn't in thermal equilibrium. I'm not sure that's answered your question, because...
When you do it in flat space, you start with a theory in four-dimensional Lorentzian metric, and you do the Euclidean rotation, and you end up with a thermal system of three dimensions, right?
So,
to my understanding, we would be here representing the statistical mechanics of a three-dimensional system. And my question, if that is like fixed time slice of the black hole?
It's really talking about the space-time exterior to the black hole. I'm not sure it is a three-dimensional system per se. Your Schwarzschild black hole, as you write it down, the metric, is eternal. Yes, it's not dependent on time. So so it's in that sense. But as I say, I'm not sure I'm able to just answer your question efficiently at this point, or at least as I've understood what you're asking. But what this approach does is it gives a different way of deriving the thermodynamics of a black hole. Now, the only reason that we use this process is because we know that we can calculate the temperature, effective temperature of a black hole in a different manner. We don't have to rotate to Euclidean time. We can look at field theory on the background of a black hole, and we get the same temperature. So it's a case of, it's a methodology that is not entirely, you know, it's It's a little bit, it's a bit dubious, but it works.
When you say black hole, you can mean two things. You can mean the black hole as a space-time for this stuff, or black hole as we see when we do the LIGO stuff, and there's just a space-like section of space-time, right?
Well, I think we would say they're one and the same. Although what we write down on the board is clearly a very simplified approximation of an astrophysical black hole.
I mean, in a sense, when I say that, it's like, is it the whole space-time history of the black hole, or it's a slice in time that we are describing in thermodynamics?
So I think we would say we were describing it instantaneously, because what we do not do when we're doing this process, we're never thinking of the back reaction of this radiation on the black hole. In describing it this way. So I guess in essence, we're sort of thinking about it captured at an instant in time, but because the black hole itself is translationally invariant in time, that it's a bit semantic really to say that we're capturing it, to talk about T equals constant surfaces. I think we're gonna have to move on now, but I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. So all I wanted to do was to just finish off by saying I'm just re-describing this. 4 pi, 2 gm is the radius of the horizon, so 4 pi times 2 gm squared is its area, and what I'm left with is a factor of 1 over 4 g, which was indeed what I claimed the entropy was when I varied the event horizon radius. So this is a completely different route to finding thermodynamics of a black hole, and it gives the same answer for the entropy. So it's some very different description. But I think given that, even though we started 5 minutes late, I suppose, but I think I probably should stop there and carry on next time.